Chester Street. Every person has, to his credit, merits and transgressions. Someone whose majority is merit is called a tzaddik, righteous. And if someone has majority of transgressions, it's called Russia, wicked. He's 50-50, he's called Bainan, intermediary. So is the country. If the merits of all its inhabitants are more than their collective transgressions, then the Medina, the country, is called righteous, and if their transgressions are majority, that's called wicked. And similarly with the world as a whole. Now, just to test your logic, what I read to you now should sound obvious, clear, poshut, simple. The truth is that it is ambiguous and it could have been taken otherwise. Let me say it over to you again. See if you can hear where the Rambam is taking a position on a controversial issue. It's not at all obvious. Now listen carefully. A person, whether the person is righteous or wicked, depends upon the majority. If in his actions the majority is mitzvos, good deeds, then he's called righteous. And if the majority is transgressions, then he's called wicked. Same is true for the, let's say, the state. If the majority of the collective actions of all the people in the state is righteous, then the state is called righteous. And if the majority of the collective actions of the people in the state is wicked, then the state is called wicked. Now I say to you that that's not obvious. That's not obvious. The move from the individual to the state is not obvious. It could have been done otherwise, and the Rambam is making a choice here. And it will make a difference. It will make a practical difference. What's the other choice? What is the Rambam done here that's not obvious?
If you let's say a person who's a big Russia, right? So he has a thousand of theirs, and Germans, but the bottom line is he's one person. You have a second person who has one more mixed amount of their, but he's still out. Eventually, he'll numbers going to add up. If each person individually, good or bad, that you shouldn't be counting everyone's of theirs and put together.
Okay, so it shouldn't be, right? You're going to be here outside. Right.
You could deal with
it. He's got it. Listen to the alternative. The alternative would be not to consider the collective actions of the entire population, not to consider the collective actions of the entire population, but to consider the population person by person. Each person's character will be determined by his majority, and then the character of the community will be determined by the majority of the people, not the majority of the actions. And it really is not obvious which way to do. How do you sum up the character of a community on the basis of the actions of the individuals? Now let's make a simple case, and I'll show you where the difference will be. Let's say there are 10 people altogether, and let's say each person has 100 actions. Six of whom are 51-49 to the bad side. And four of whom are 99-1 to the good side. Now, if I sum up all the actions, irrespective of who does them, then the sum total will be on which side? Oh, good. Can't calculate. On the good side, right? Six out of ten are almost equal, and four out of ten are lopsided on the good side. So the sum total of action will be way lopsided on the good side. But if I add up people, I've got six evil people and four good people. So I do it on the basis of people, the majority is going to be evil. Now the Rambam has decided to do it on the basis of the sum total of actions, dissolving through the people. Right? That's not exactly obvious. Could have done otherwise. Right? Okay. Now, I'm not going to argue one second, there are others who want to do it the other way, but I'm just pointing out that a decision has been made here. Now the Rambam says, a person whose transgressions are the majority more than his merits, miyad hu meis, he dies instantly. And he quotes a verse. And the same for the country, if its actions are majority of evil, then it immediately is destroyed. And same for the whole world. If the majority of the actions of the whole world would be transgressions, then it is destroyed. So now, according to what we said, a few very good people can compensate for a large population of people who are slightly over the evil side. Slightly over the evil side. Doesn't, don't take account the identity of the individual. Good. So now I want you to know, I mean, you shouldn't have the alarm bell for you in your head already. A person who is majority of transgressions dies immediately, says the Ravid. Lokomotion who's so there. Not like this one thinks. Speaking about the Rambam. Not like this one thinks. It's not true. Wicked people can live a long time. Quote what the Rambam thinks the Rambam is relating to. Simply not true. We would say, can't you see that wicked people are alive? How can you say that wicked people die instantly? Someone who's majority of transgressions. Just a majority. That's all it needs. Right? Aren't there people who are running around who are clearly the majority of transgressions? Now, I just want to tip you off. You read the Rambam and you hear the Ravid, his great critic, and the Ravid is sometimes quite bitter against the Rambam. He treats him, you know, like he can throw him away. Not like he thinks. You know, it's just not true. I think, where's respect for the Rambam? How could the Ravid write his critique in such cavalier terms? Let me let you in on a little historical secret that nobody knows. The Ravid was older than the Rambam. The Ravid was older. People think because the Ravid wrote a particular Rambam, has to come later. No, he was older. He was an established Rosh Yeshiva where the Rambam started writing. And manuscripts were circulated. He had a yeshiva in France. And when the manuscripts arrived at the Ravid, the Ravid said, okay, there's this young scholar. Let's see what he says. Doesn't make sense. Good. Doesn't make sense. We'll tell him so. That's why he writes the way he does. Anyway, how can the Rambam say that a person who's a majority of evil, of wicked actions, dies instantly? The answer, says the Ketzer Mishnah, is the continuation of the words thereof. Listen carefully. Rishikul Zeh, this weighing up the majority. Eino l'fi minyan hazchuyos v'avonos elo l'fi gova. It's not according to the number of good and bad actions, mitzvot and transgressions. You don't just count them up as a number, but according to their size. Yezchus chi kineged kama avonos. There can be one mitzvah that weighs equally as several transgressions together. The Yeshamot, Shukhnege Tamas Huyos. That's one transgression that's so big that it weighs equally to several Ipsos. Each of these quotes verses. So it's not the number, that you have to take into account the size of each. Now, how do you evaluate the size of an action, the size of a mitzvah, and the size of a transgression? So here, I think, intuitively one might say, we have certain yardsticks for this. You could do it by the punishment. The more serious the punishment, the more serious the transgression. Punishment for omitting a mitzvah will tell you how much doing a mitzvah is worth. I mean, we could at least get some information as to how to judge the relative size of these things. The Rambam says no. The ain shoklin elo v'dato shel kel deos. This weighing is done only with the judgment of kel deos. Now, this is a title for God which I don't think is used anywhere else. The God of Deos. What are Deos? So Deos sometimes means intellectual opinions. Sometimes Deos means character traits. And indeed, in this section of the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam has a subject called Hilchos Deos, the laws of Deos, and there it is talking about character development. And since that's only two sections back, it seems that he's giving God the title, the God of character, character traits. He knows, he knows how to evaluate merits against transgressions. Now what is Rambam saying? I think what Rambam is saying is this. Remember, the Rambam is a philosopher, so it is certainly fair to use the tools of philosophy to explain what he means. What is a human action? What is an action? An action is not just the motion of a body with consequences. An action is an expression of a purpose and a view of the world. That's what makes the motion of the body a human action. If there isn't, behind this motion of the body, a purpose and a view of the world, then it's not a human action. Let me give you some examples to explain what I mean. What's the difference between an avalanche and a suicide bomber? Both kill people. Innocent people. Indiscriminately. The avalanche is not an action. Avalanche is an event. It's a happening. Suppose someone is blown over by the wind and lands on an electrical connection which then explodes. That's also not an action. There, the person's no different from a stick of wood. Could have been a stick of wood blown by the wind into the electrical connection. It wasn't. It was a person blown into the electrical connection. The fact that it's a human body doesn't make it into an action. Suppose someone does something unknowingly, in ignorance, something he couldn't have known. We say he's not responsible. Why not? He did it. It had its consequences. So why don't we hold them responsible? Because there's no purpose behind it and no conception of the world behind it that led him to do it. Doctors, 150 years ago, used to bleed people with fevers. That was actually bad to the health. That's why we don't do it anymore, right? Do we hold the doctors responsible for injuring people? No, because for the injury, there was no purpose and no conception behind it. The doctor had no purpose in injuring the people. There's no worldview of injuring them behind what he did. So the injury was not an action. Now, when a person performs an action and you're evaluating the person, you can't evaluate the person on the basis of the character of the motion of his body alone. The action, the character of the event as an action, depends upon his purpose and his conception of the world. Two people can move their bodies in identical ways and thereby perform very different actions. I lived through the Vietnam War era. That time, students sat down in the middle of streets and took over government buildings and university buildings. And there was a great debate what to do about these students. There was a group of people who said, call out the National Guard and beat them up good. Now this group had two subgroups. One subgroup was the far right, who said, beat them up and teach them a lesson. Break a few bones. Teach them what the real world is like. The other subgroup was the far left. They said, call out the state troopers, beat them up, break a few bones, and that's where you will stimulate a revolution which will overthrow the government. Now, you're watching the vote in the legislature. How many are voting for brutal state troopers? Up go the hands. You don't know what that means. One guy's voting to break the protest, and the other guy's voting to stimulate a revolution against the government. Unless you know what the person's purpose is and his picture of the world, you don't know what he is doing. The Rambam is saying here that we're evaluating the person as wicked or righteous. You can't do that on the basis of the external effects of the action. You can't do it on the basis of the legal status of the action alone. You have to take into account what it means to him personally. You can have a person whose actions are horrendous. Why? Through ignorance? Or through addiction? Through warped character, twisted character? And, on one occasion, makes a supreme effort against his character to do something good, and that one heroic action may be worth more than all of the evil that he does. And of course, looking from the outside, you can't possibly know that. So the Rambam, so to speak, is covering his basis here by saying that this evaluation of what the majority is can only be made by someone, by God, takes into account the person's inner character. Yeah. First of all, it has nothing to do with Yom Kippur. If he goes over the line on January, that's it, he's finished. No, it has nothing to do with Yom Kippur. If in January he eats that one extra cheeseburger, right? And he was 50-50 up until that moment, he eats that cheeseburger, he's done. He'll get struck by lightning. Whenever you step over the line, you're dead. That's what he says. If he's not yet over the line, and you keep it as Jewish, that could wipe out his liabilities for the transgressions, and then he starts out with a different slate. That's true. But if he steps over the line, according to what he says, miyad who makes, he dies instantly. Won't make it the Yom Kippur. Yeah.
If I meet with somebody on Shabbos, a true Shabbos, he doesn't take Shabbos, then they have a purpose and a worldview of that?
Who knows? All I'm saying is the evaluation of what he does depends upon whether he has a purpose in the world. Yeah.
The only reason he died
for the No. No, no, that's important. This is a sufficient condition to die. Not a necessary condition to die. There's all sorts of other reasons why a person dies. But this is for sure. Right? The problem here is that it looks like a counterexample. There are people who are definitely over the line and don't die. But you're quite right. There could be other reasons why people die. Quite right, yeah.
You could interpret it like people that are not living according to Torah life are not really living. And the other thing is that some people that are evil are getting paid in this world, so they don't get paid in the next world.
Okay, I don't know if the Rambam actually brings that. We'll have to talk about that. But the first point that you make is extremely important. It's really implied by what I said, but let's draw out the implication. I said it's only an action which is responsible if you have a worldview and a purpose behind it. Now let's imagine, like those doctors, who are ignorant, so we don't count them responsible for it. Now let's take people who don't live a life of Torah, because they don't know what the Torah is, they have no idea what it means, so as you say, they're not really living. Those things that they're doing aren't really actions. They're just based on their ignorance. And the Torah has many principles that either eliminate or at least reduce a person's responsibility and liability on the basis of his ignorance. The more ignorant he is, the less responsible he is for what he's doing. There's a very dramatic case in the Gemara on Shabbos. One of the Maroim said, if someone were chasing me, trying to kill me, and I had the opportunity to take refuge in one of two houses, in one house lives a Jewish idol worshiper, and in the other house lives a non-Jewish idol worshiper, where should I take refuge? He says, I'd rather take refuge with the non-Jewish idol worshiper, because he knows less, and therefore he's less corrupt. Whereas the Jewish idol worshiper, if he went to idol worship having known what the truth was, he's more corrupt, and therefore he's more dangerous. So we definitely, I mean, there's lots of principles like this. And anyway.
But the Rambam introduced the worldview and the purpose?
No, this, I'm telling you something that's obvious. Once you think about it, it just works here to explain it, the background for his view. Of course not. Any intelligent person knows that. Yeah.
The story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
He brings that.
Oh.
He says, because it says, I'll go down and see ki rabo, if it's majority. He quotes the verse, it says the words, there's majority. If it's majority, then they're going down the drain. But he interprets rabo, not many or great, but rope. Majority. Is that what you want to ask, or you?
Well, in case of Sodom and Gomorrah, the rope was not really righteous, right? All of the Sodom and Gomorrah, they were wicked, and Akudar Baruch was going to destroy them.
Yes.
And Abraham then asked if the city is going to be destroyed if there are 10 righteous people, right?
So you could interpret that the way we said it. In other words, if all the people there are just over the line, and the righteous people are very righteous, and they can count it back.
But that contradicts Rambam, then?
No, I just explained it. Again, if you're not going to do it by the identity of the people, but just by the sum total of actions. So let's say you have 1,000 people, each of whom is just...
Right,
just
right. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Then why would he have to request?
Why would he have to request?
Unless you're saying on behalf of my request.
You'll have to say that he didn't know it. He didn't know the rules. I guess that's a good question. I think that you'll have to say he didn't know how the rules are run. Indeed, since there is an ambiguity here, so to ask for 50, even though they're a minority, already means that you are prejudicing it against the majority of people. Right? And then I don't know how far that goes. Yeah.
You know, some concept how standard mitzvah is worth more points than it's in a bear.
A standard?
It pays you a lot more for doing mitzvah than punishes you for doing a bear. Isn't that the Jewish thing tomorrow, maybe?
Well, okay. What I'm saying is that punishment and reward do not count here. It's not punishment and reward that determine which is the bigger action. So we don't have to take account of that. Right, that's not how the calculation is made. Okay. Now comes a very tricky and famous statement. Rambam makes based on Mishnah, and we'll have to calculate it carefully. Because it requires Kobi shel nichan ala mitzvos she'oso v'toha al hazuchuyos v'ono v'libo u'machu al tibasi yoson halvai lu asisi yoson harize ibei eskulo. A person does mitzvos and later he says, I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I had not done that mitzvah or those mitzvahs. And I don't care about the merits that I earned. I wish that I hadn't done it. This change of mind this regret, we could call it. What is regret? Suffices to wipe out his credit for those mitzvahs. They maskir lo shum zchus ba'olam, and we don't mention to him any merit for having done it. And he quotes a verse. Did mitzvahs, he thinks, I broke off that conversation, that business conversation in the middle of going down the minhag, and somebody else got the deal, and I lost $15,000. What a stupid thing to do. You know, you can make up minhag, you miss minhag, you talk about it twice, so and so, okay, maybe show you, I don't remember that shogun after all. Anyway, what a stupid thing. Minhag, I down in minhag, lost $15,000. Boy, that was dumb. I was a merit in Dari Mincha, I'd give up the merit, I'd give up the mitzvah. If I had to do it again, I would regret it. I'll leave out the high. I regret it. I wish I hadn't done it. That's enough to wipe out his credit for doing the mitzvah. Now, the Bukhan of Asman asked the following question. What does it take to wipe out a transgression? To wipe out a transgression, you have to do tshuva. Tshuva has three parts. You have to regret the transgression you did. You have to make up your mind you're never going to do that transgression again. And you have to confess. Three things in order to wipe out the transgression. Here, the Rambam is saying that in order to lose merit for a mitzvah, all you have to do is regret. I wish I hadn't done it. Comes out, according to the Rambam is saying, is that it's easier to lose the credit for a mitzvah than it is to wipe out the benefit. To wipe out the penalty for a transgression. It's easier to lose the credit for a mitzvah than it is to wipe out the penalty for a transgression. It means that God is being, how should we put it, very strict. Strict in an unbalanced way. He's making it hard to rehabilitate and easy to deteriorate. Now we have a rule. The rule is that God's character of doing good, of helping, his relationship of love is always superior to his relationship of punishment. Read it, Meruba Mida, Mida Tobin, Mida Zaparonim. And here it seems to be the opposite. Here, God's commitment to punishment is stronger than his commitment to reward. He's committed to punishment so strongly that to change it, you've got to have a three-part performance. Commitment to reward is so weak that one move destroys the reward. So this is the opposite of the principle that God's commitment to reward and to goodness is always greater than his commitment to punishment. Now, Rabbi Chanan answers this question on the basis of a Ramchal. The Ramchal says in a number of places, analyzing what happens when a person does a mitzvah or an aveirah, understanding that it has two different effects, and that the parts of tshuva are addressed to the different parts, and what's going on here is that we're talking about different aspects of the mitzvah and the aveirah. Let's analyze an aveirah. What happens when a person performs an aveirah? Mano mitzvah. Two things happen. Number one, there's disobedience. God commanded X, and he said no. Number two, the action has consequences. Consequences for him, consequences for the people around him, consequences for the world as a whole. Certain things could have come into the world, were on route to the world, and by performing this transgression, he stops up the channels of transmission of those things, can't reach the world. There are two effects. The effect of disobedience and the effects of the world, hitting the world, changing the world. Now, when a person regrets what he's done, and when a person resolves to change the future, how are they related to those two parts of his transgression? Do they pair off? Could we say that regretting the transgression corresponds to, could be aimed at one part of the transgression and rectified, and deciding to change the behavior is aimed at the other part and rectifies it? Can we divide them up that way? The Lachana wants to divide them up that way. Resolving to change, resolving not to do it again, corresponds to the disobedience. Before he decided to rebel, how do you rectify the decision to rebel? By making up your mind that you're not going to rebel. It changes precisely what the problem was. The problem was deciding against. So, oh, I'm not doing that anymore. Now I'm deciding for. So by changing his decision, he rectifies the wrong decision. Regret, the pain, the thought that what I did was terrible. I wish I hadn't done it. If I could go back, I would go back and fix it. That rectifies the effect of his action. Now, when the Rambam says here that a person who regrets his command, his mitzvos, he doesn't get any merit from it, says Rabbi Chana, what he's talking about is the merit of obedience. The merit of obedience. God told me to do it, and I did it. Now he says, I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I hadn't done it. Okay, so that will, that decision to do it, now he wishes he hadn't done it. But that can't change the fact that when he did it, he affected the world. The world got a certain character instilled in it, and that character of the world carries on. So you have to say that there's a parallelism. There's a parallelism if you distinguish the aspects of the performance. It isn't that his mitzvah is totally wiped out when he regrets having done it. He says, I wish I hadn't done it. It's not that the whole thing is wiped out. What's wiped out is the obedience. But the rest of it stays. In tshuva, when you want to wipe out the entire transgression, all of it, then you have to have all parts of tshuva. Correct. Because you're wiping out much more. And indeed, wiping out the consequences of the action. I mentioned this to you in the beginning. That's really paradoxical. How can my changing my character now do anything to the consequences of the action? The world changed. I made an impact upon the world. The world isn't the same world. Right? Whatever I do now isn't going to go back and change the past. The past just is. So I change myself from now on. I'm a much better person from now on. So what? Why should that? It certainly doesn't change the events in the past. And why should it change my liability to the events in the past? Human justice doesn't work that way. Somebody performs a criminal action, damages or injures somebody, and then he reforms himself and becomes a model citizen. He still has to pay for what he did. You can't say, well, now you're a good guy, so you're relieved of liability. On the contrary, if you're such a good guy, pay for what you did. God doesn't require that, because it would be impossible. We can't rectify it. And God says, you tshuva, I'm also going to wipe out for you the consequences of what you did. That goes beyond normal human life. So for that, you have to do the whole of tshuva. In case of the mitzvah, all you lose is the credit for the obedience. Because now, you say, I wish I hadn't done it. So you changed your character. You'd rather be disobedient. Okay, then you're no longer going to carry that credit for obedience. But what you did to the world still stands. That way you can see that they're at least parallel. It's not that they got it more strict with respect to mitzvot than with respect to transgression. Okay, skipping a little bit because the next part is extremely difficult and I've got time to take you through all the details. Now he said, even though blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah is a zeiras hakasuv, a decree of the verse, remez yeshbo, kolomar, ur yisheni mishinaska, the nirgomim hekitsu mitardamaska, the chipsu b'maaseka, the chizu b'tshuva, the zikru b'rach. I want to expand a little bit because there's a whole philosophy here. Even though the blowing of the shofar Rosh Hashanah is a decree of the verse, there's a hint in it. That is to say, you who are asleep, awake from your sleep. Those of you who are in a trance, in a stupor, wake up from your stupor. Analyze your actions and do truth. Remember your Creator. The Gemara often asks a certain mitzvah. The Gemara says, why do we do that mitzvah? And the Gemara answers, Rachman Omar, God said to do it. The bottom line in any mitzvah, if he asks why do we do it, is that God said to do it. That's called a Gzeres HaKosu. The Torah said to do it. Still, you could ask, not why did God command it? What was in his mind? Can I peek into God's biography or his private notes when he decided to make this mitzvah? Did he write those notes? This is what I meant. Can I sort of sneak into the palace and get to the private records chamber? Can I take a look there and see what he meant? But yeah. But you could analyze the content of the command. Not why. But, for example, what effect does it have? What effect does it have? Look at its content. Look at its associations. And try to analyze the meaning in the performance, let alone why God told you to do it. So let's see. We're starting from the bottom. We have the whole of the Torah in front of us. We have all the commandments. We have the associations. I wish I had put together a picture of what this thing does. So, number one, Rosh Hashanah is the Day of Judgment. Day of Judgment would be a day to analyze and try to prove and evaluate. Now, let's see the shofar. What does the shofar do? What kinds of functions does the shofar have in general? Well, in the wilderness it was used to call together the camp. And it was used in times of war. And this was used on the holidays, times of great joy. So either it's organizing a communal effort, or it's expressing an emotion that needs to be expressed. All right, so now it's Rosh Hashanah. Is there any effort that's relevant to Rosh Hashanah? Is there something that should be done? Yes, since it's the Day of Judgment, the person should prepare himself, the community should prepare itself, try to respond to the judgment in the best possible way. Is there a dominant emotion? Yes, the emotion is one of concern, worry, even fright. So if I take what I know about shofar from other places, then I can read this hint in the shofar. Wake up from your sleep. It's a cry of danger, like a call to war. And it's a call to action, because it's a time of danger and a time of action. Right? That, I think, is what's going on. The Rambam says even though it's Yeras HaKosuv, it's a decree of the birds. That means it's God's decree. Nobody can read God's mind. We're not speculating as to what's going on in his mind. That's none of our business. Still, he says there's a remnant, there's a hint in it. So where did the hint come from? The hint has to come post facto. Given what he's told me, I can put it together to see a theme in it. That's not trying to go behind it to figure out what God means. Okay? It's very important to understand, but the logic of what the Rambam is doing here. Now, he says, since I told you that it's a question of majority, everything's a question of majority, therefore, every person should see himself all year long as if he is 50-50. And as if the whole world is 50-50. That being the case, if he does one transgression, he'll push himself and the whole world over to the evil side. And if he does one mitzvah, he'll push himself and the whole world over to the good side. And he will thereby cause for himself and for the world salvation. That's what he should do. Now, first of all, as a footnote of what we said before, you can only say this if you do it his way, that you count up the actions individually. Because if you count it up by people, there's no guarantee that his one action will do anything to anybody. Okay, but let's say so. Now, why should he do this? Isn't this extraordinarily unlikely? Isn't this extraordinarily unlikely? That I'm 50-50 and the whole world is 50-50, so that my next action will make the difference? Not only is it extraordinarily unlikely when you think about it abstractly, but you have a lot of evidence that it isn't so. What's your evidence? Because all previous occasions of which you performed a transgression, you should have pushed the world over and the world should have been destroyed. And it didn't happen, did it? So at least on those occasions, you know it wasn't true. So why should I go through this fantasy that I'm 50-50 and the whole world is 50-50 when number one, it's very unlikely in and of itself. And number two, from my own experience, I know the cases where I thought that, I have a demonstration that it's not true many, many times. Okay, I think there are two answers here. Number one, I don't know if you've ever been through this, but you're on the football team, and it's the end of the first half, and you're down by 17 points. And the coach comes in and says, listen, we can still do it. You know, they're weak, and they're tired, and they're overconfident. And if we really push, you know, we can overcome them. We'll do this play, we'll do that play. He gives a pep talk to the team. What's really going on in his mind? With 17 points down. We're going to win this game? No, we're not going to win this game. But instead of losing by 34, they'll get another 17 points in the second half. If I talk to these guys and it's lose them, it will only lose by 26. We'll lose by 34. It could be that the team, that the players themselves sort of know this. But they play along. Because if you've ever been involved in sports, you know that the majority of your performance on the field is psychological. Your psychology is much more important than your muscles, your coordination, your strength. You have to be up for the game. You're not up for the game? It robs you. It robs you of your strength. So you can play a game with yourself. You can talk yourself into it. And your performance will be much better. So it could be picturing this picture that in my next action I can make the difference between the survival or of the destruction of the world can call out in you a greater performance, even if another part of your mind knows it's not really true, but you don't pay attention to that for the minute. You think to yourself, everything depends upon me, and with that mental set, you can get a greater performance. I think that's not trivial as part of the explanation here. But there's another part of the explanation that I think is a little more philosophical. Let's suppose the world is really 60-40. It's really 64. Oh, and I do a mitzvah. Well, my mitzvah is part of it, 60%. Millions and millions and millions of actions. It's part of the 60%, you know, the millions that are on the majority. Did my action push it over the majority? Is mine at that the dividing line where mine pushes it over and then all the rest of them are extra? Well, who's to say it isn't on the dividing line? Which of that 60% majority pushes it over the dividing line? Isn't it really all of them together? Isn't it really all of the good actions together that makes it a majority? So, even, I mean, now the fantasy of 50-50 becomes a kind of vivid way of making a philosophical point. Everyone who does a mitzvah is contributing to that majority. And he has an equal share of the majority, an equal responsibility for the majority. So, at least on the positive side, and if God forbid the world would have slipped over to the negative, as it did in the time of the flood, then everyone who performs the transgressions can't say, well, but there's so many transgressions, what do I care? What do I care? What do I count? Everyone who performs the transgression is contributing to that majority of transgressions. So yes, I am related to making it into a majority, even if, strictly speaking, numerically, it isn't 50-50. That's another way to read it and make some sense out of it. Other than that, I don't know what to say, because as we can see, that the idea that's really 50-50 is utterly unrealistic. Okay? All right.